What's up?
What's up, Funky Crypto Podcast? Welcome, everyone. Welcome.
Welcome to episode 21. Guys, happy Bitcoin halving day. This happened just by chance. We didn't plan to do this, but we're going to do it anyways. Jameson, how are you doing today?
Doing well. It's a good day for countdowns.
It is great. John, you put two countdowns on one intro. I didn't know about that. That was a
no hate, participate.
Sure. let's get right into this. Now, Jameson's got a busy day. He's all over the place, a man in demand. So, Jameson, how did you get into Bitcoin?
Well, I'm a nerd. I'm a computer scientist by trade. And so I would spend a lot of times on nerd sites like Slashdot and, you know, that's probably not where I first heard about it, but it's definitely where I heard about it for the third or fourth time and eventually ended up reading the white paper and really got interested, started going down the rabbit hole. It was 2 years of doing just enthusiast side projects after initially reading the white paper that I then figured I could go full time. So now I've been full time doing Bitcoin security for over 5 years.
Wow. So you've been full time. So, man, that puts you back like, probably, you know, starting getting your feelers in at what, like 2013?
So I actually just tweeted it out earlier, but I was there for the first halving and it was a complete, you know, non-event. Not many people were talking about it. And in fact, my tweet that I made at the time got like no retweet, maybe three likes, no response. And so it's funny to look back on now and people are asking like, why was nobody, you know, talking to you at the time? I was like, well, nobody was listening to me. I was talking all the time, but nobody was listening.
Yeah. That's, you know what? I'm going to come honest with you guys. This is my first halving. I got into it in August of 2017. So you're right as the run up was getting going. So this is my first halving and it seems as though there's a shitload of attention around it.
For sure. Every time, you know, it's another order of magnitude of interest and therefore a larger diversity of people that are doing their own thing. And so we get interesting websites and other projects and people building their countdown timers.
Yeah, that's
So what was the cheapest Bitcoin you ever bought? What was the price when you first bought it?
It was around the $10 mark.
Oh, beautiful.
That is yeah. So
beautiful. That's so
I was
beautiful.
On Mount Gox.
That's messed up.
Oh, you were on Mount Gox?
I was. Thankfully, whoa. I did not keep my coins on the exchange. I know a lot of people who are not quite so fortunate.
Well, that would be something that would inspire your future endeavors because that is a mess of security right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, hey, I'm guessing your answer is going to be freedom, but you can tell me if I'm wrong. And we ask this question to every one of our guests now. Well, what do you think the biggest value proposition of Bitcoin is?
It is actually in taking power away from small groups of people. So it is freedom in a sense. The way that I like to actually portray it, it's not so much that we have taken away or changed the power of existing governments or central banks in what they do with their own money. Rather, we have empowered everyone else to create their own money. We have really opened up the market, you know, freed the market as it were for money to compete with each other.
Yeah, that's freedom in what it's worth, right, John? What do you think?
That's right. Freedom. This is all about freedom. It's about censorship resistant money. And James Lopp, man, he's got what, 220,000 followers? He blew up on Twitter. I heard he was at like 10,000. Mm-hmm. And then we had that bull run. And then, you know, my man just blew up on people. And now he's all about that privacy and security. So glad we have him on the show, man.
Yeah. Well, so James, one of the things I wanted to push back on, I listened to a couple of your podcasts with Peter McCormick. And you know, I'm very curious to hear what your take is, but you know, you said something like people aren't used to having their personal responsibility with money. They're used to relying on, you know, third party people who take care of all their screw ups or something to that effect.
Yep.
And so I guess here's my question. I mean, there's a lot of things today with the modern economy that I can get done that I don't have to know how to do, right? I don't have to know how to fix my car, for example, right? I can go to a mechanic. I would much rather spend my money to exchange the mechanic's time for fixing my car than actually to understand how to do it myself. Although, obviously, if it was some type of doomsday scenario and I had to fix my own car, I'd probably be screwed. And so, you know, I told John, I've been in since, I told you guys, August of 2017. So I'm 3 years in. And on top of that, I have very, very low anxiety. I mean, I fight people in a cage for a living, or I did, mm-hmm. right? And so I don't have a lot of fear or anxiety. But yeah. Other people, every time I log on to my trades, I'm still like, shit, I hope this money's, I hope this Bitcoin's still here. And so I feel like there is going to need to be something that makes all those lazy people have a really easy capability of getting access to Bitcoin or other crypto.
Yeah, you make an excellent point, which is it's understandable how society has evolved to where we are right now. You know, we have over millennia created these hierarchical command and control structures. And the reason mm-hmm. is all efficiency, right? It is yeah. specialization. If it wasn't for specialization, then you would have to worry about growing your own food and basically worry about basic survival skills, which is far more intensive than you being able to specialize on punching somebody in the face and let other people worry about fixing your car.
Or podcasts, right?
So ultimately, you know, the problem is like, how does this conflict with some of the mantras we have in Bitcoin, you know, trustlessness, yeah. don't trust, verify, you know, be sovereign, be your own bank, all yada, yada, yada. Those things come with additional responsibility if you want the power to really take control of your Bitcoin and have the censorship resistance and all of these other valuable attributes. So what do you do if you want to be your own bank, but you don't want to, you know, learn all the technical underpinnings of the protocol? Yeah. This is where, I mean, this is really what I've been doing, which is how do we create software where we can leverage, you know, my technical expertise, the specialization of myself and my coworkers that we've built up over many years learning about Bitcoin security, and allow people to use our software, which has a lot of the best practices and all this technical mumbo jumbo built into yeah. it. So you just follow the directions on the screen and don't have to know all the dirty IT management stuff, but do this in a way where we don't have to have your private keys. So we can't control your money, but we can help you help yourself. It is yeah. really specialization for self-empowerment is kind of what I'm going for.
Nice. Okay. And that's, yeah, so you should promote yourself a little bit. It is Casa HODL, and I know that's one of the things John always says to me is, you know, you can exchange speed for safety or safety for speed, but you can only, you know, really have one, or expediency, right? And you can really only have one at the end of the day. You can only have one, or you got to pick what mix of them you're going to have.
There are many different trade-offs. The most common one that we see in, you know, crypto and security is convenience versus security.
Yeah, sure.
So it's so much easier just to, you know, log into your Coinbase account and you know, access your Bitcoin IOUs, you know, ask Coinbase to do things on your behalf. But then as a result, it's also creating a very different threat model where there are many other potential points of failure, both like internal to Coinbase and external with other people who might get into your account and then mm-hmm. instruct Coinbase to send out the coins to somewhere you don't want them to go.
Yeah. Didn't they just have something last week? I think they went down last week, and didn't they have some type of virus or something?
I mean, it was a busy week. They got overwhelmed a bit, but in general, you know, we see people get their accounts compromised on exchanges all the time. You know, sometimes it's more sophisticated than other times, but it really comes down to the fact that, you know, your keys are still online, or at least the keys that are being held by this third party are online. And that's one of the many, many things that we guard against with what we've set up at Casa.
Yeah. Okay. So So I agree with everything you said there. So with the CASA system, and maybe you can just explain this to everyone. And this is going to be, I feel like this is going to be tough to explain to new people, but hell, let's go for it anyways. And if I get this wrong, correct me. You have three cold wallets, right? Trezor, Ledger, whatever. And you need a combination of them to access the funds in your account. And this is something then, you know, if you lose one, then CASA can help you replace one of the three, which means you still have, you still have three wallets. And so there's no way anyone can, you know, hold you at gunpoint or steal your Trezor and somehow have your password, and, you know, just at one swipe, because they would have to get all three of them, correct?
Yeah. So the fundamental piece of technology that we're leveraging that's part of the Bitcoin protocol is something called multi-sig. Basically, it means instead of having a single key sign off on creating a Bitcoin transaction, you need several. And we have a couple of different setups. One of them is 2 out of 3, where you need 2 signatures out of 3 possible. Another at the higher level is 3 out of 5. You know, as these numbers go up, you're essentially creating more resiliency, more redundancy, and we're building this on top of, like you said, the existing hardware out there, like the Trezors and Ledgers. Now, the really important part is that then the user physically distributes these devices. Mm-hmm. Home, office, friend's house, safety deposit box. We hold one offline at CASA for emergency situations. And it's this distribution that gives you a level of resilience against both attack and just simple loss due to any number of things like a house fire, natural disaster, what have you. The most important thing that we can do is eliminate single points of failure. And that's what scares everybody, right? Is even if you are, if you take that first step and you get your coins off the exchange, you put them on a Trezor. Well, now you've got all your keys sitting right here and there's so many things yep, that can go wrong. And so the point is we understand, you know, Bitcoin has always had the promise of be your own bank, but I think that's not good enough because a bank is still like one single place that could have something go wrong with it. Instead, we can actually now with the technology, we can do better than a bank. We can create this distributed resilient setup that can withstand any number of attacks and disasters that a single bank wouldn't be able to. And the great thing is we can actually make it easy. With CASA, it's just a mobile app. Like all of this technical stuff that we're talking about is all under the hood. It's abstracted away. You're just tapping on the app and following the instructions and plugging in your device when you're prompted to do so.
Nice.
Wow. You know, we have a community called Litecoin Fam, and we go out and push for adoption. And my friend Johnny Litecoin, he's in the merchant service business, and he always says this: nobody cares until it happens to them, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody cares to protect themselves and their information until they get a charge back that they lose money. So like so many people these days, like I've heard your podcast and when I'm hearing it, I'm pumped. Like, oh, I'm going to go home and take my phone number off of everything and just whatever. But because I'm not a victim yet, it doesn't push me to do it. But Jameson, you've been a victim of some crazy things.
I read about this.
Can you give us a little bit a story of what happened with you at your house?
Yeah, so you know, I have a different perspective than a lot of people, and part of that is what has happened to me personally. Part of it is because of what I've seen while working in the Bitcoin security industry. I've seen many hard lessons learned by other people who made mistakes and ended up losing millions and millions of dollars in an instant. Now, as for myself, like shit got real when I had a SWAT team shut down my whole neighborhood.
Yeah. Now, jeez.
You know, that was related to all this Bitcoin stuff. You know, basically part of my rise to prominence on Twitter during the 2017 hype resulted in me going from a few thousand to like 100,000 followers. And, you know, this is just the law of large numbers. You know, any celebrity has to deal with this. If once you have enough attention, once you have, you know, millions of people who are watching you, the statistical likelihood that one or more of them is going to be unhinged and will do something to try to harm you starts to go up. And so I reached some threshold where a guy who had the technical ability to know how to place an anonymous phone call and say the right phrases to my local police department that would get them to send out the SWAT team. He managed to do it, and he, you know, he was trying to extort me for Bitcoin, because you figured, hey, this guy's been in Bitcoin for a few years. Maybe if I scare him bad enough, he'll just pay me off. Funnily enough, the guy was trying to extort me for about $50,000 in Bitcoin. And of course, I didn't pay him anything, but I ended up spending about that much to burn down my entire life and start it all over again with a removed privacy. So the money has been spent, but not for, you know, its intended purpose. It's actually, instead of a one-time payoff, this has hardened my entire operational security posture.
So are you totally off the grid now?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you define off the grid. You know, obviously, I still have internet connection. I'm still able to communicate. I mean, I've worked remotely for 5 years, the entire time I've been working in Bitcoin. However, I'm off the grid from the sense that there is nothing out there that connects my identity to my physical address. I'm using proxies of all kinds as a shielding mechanism to protect me. I'm using digital proxies, you know, VPNs and Tor to protect my online traffic. I'm using legal proxies in the form of anonymous corporations and trusts where I'm not listed on those, but those are the things that actually own my different properties. They're not connected to me legally, creating a paper trail. And I'm using proxies in the sense of other people, where if I want to, you know, receive physical things, I have other like private mailboxes that are managed by other people, and so I can, you know,
that's crazy.
We have like a Tor network of mailing addresses that like hop physical mail around the country.
Wow,
stuff like that is
That's a thing.
All right, so
yeah,
really.
So, hold on. Oh, so I see two things. Number one, Ben, you have way more followers than James, so you need to really start thinking.
Hold on. Do you go on public?
Okay, so this is where I really
I'm sorry. And question number two, are you really scared for your own safety, or is this something that like you're doing it to try to get really good at this?
It's more the latter, but I'll tell you my perspective.
Okay.
And this is what really came true. But like the way that I tell people to approach security, whether it's physical or digital or whatever, is that you should think through what your current threat assessment is and then 10x that and build your security to be, you know, robust against 10x more of whatever it is that you're currently worried about.
Yeah.
Because that's what happened to me, right? I went from having a few thousand to 100,000 followers. My threat profile ballooned because I had so much more attention, so much more scrutiny, people trying to poke and prod and find the holes in my system. I mean, that was the only time I got physically attacked. But I mean, I was getting digitally attacked, like all my different online properties
were
getting attacked, you know, on a regular basis once I went into the Bitcoin security space. And that's just, you know, spear phishing becomes a thing whenever you're, you know, protecting a lot of people's money. But I do go out physically, but this is one thing where I've really taken it to the extreme is that I moved to a new location and I created an alias. So no one around here knows my real name and identity. They know my alias. Then they know that I work as a software engineer, so I can maintain the like technical facade, as it were. But part of it is just that that's another shield where no one here even knows that I am me. Therefore, it's not even possible for them to leak that information.
What? Come on. You probably won't tell us your fake name, will you?
No, probably not. But it's like, you know, it's common, plausible name, right? It's something that
Rodney Smith.
Not too common.
Okay, and you moved to a place where nobody knew you, because obviously, like, if you move one town over and someone saw you, then they'd be like, no, that's not Bob. That's Jameson.
Yeah, but you know, I had only ever been recognized in real life one time, and that's when I was in Silicon Valley, so it wasn't that surprising.
Okay.
So I can still get away with it.
Do you go to any, like, say, you know, like last year I went to the Litecoin convention. Do you go to any type of things like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I still go to various physical Bitcoin and crypto events. I just take care in how I travel to them.
Got it. Okay. Wow. That's fascinating.
And Lop, I know you're a big gun lover, right? You're freedom of the Second Amendment. You love all that. And right before the show, I mean, you even, you know, showed me that you're not playing around. So you carry
weird guns. We had guns on the show before I came on.
It's legal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always within, you know, close reach of this is just another part of security posture. You know, if I have a physical attacker, I would prefer not to have to engage them hand to hand. You know, if I have the ability to amplify my power and I have, you know, training and a number of different weapons that I can do that with, then I'm going to use whatever I can to my advantage.
Wow. Yeah.
So. Jameson, we're going to ask you, if we ever meet you, we're going to say, put the gun down. let's fight man to man, because that's the only chance we've got against you.
I have to admit that I did a couple of years of Krav Maga training, so I don't fight cleanly. I don't play by any rules. I might accidentally gouge your eyes out.
I've been my guy.
Hey, my eyes are too small. No. You can't gouge it out.
Oh, my. The Lyman good fight. He gouged my eyes like a son of a gun. That was not really fun at all. I don't know how the ref did not catch it. Wow. Yeah. So, okay, Jameson. You know, one of the other things that I picked up from your Peter McCormick podcast was you. I don't want to say you didn't have a strong opinion, but you were more kind of low key. I don't want to say neutral, but, you know, like not really, really strongly opinionated on the Bitcoin versus Bcash topic. And I found it interesting because usually people have a really, really, really strong opinion. They're either this side or this side, and that's it. But you were kind of like, I kind of see his perspective. I kind of see their perspective, and I see what they're getting at. And I really like that. I appreciate that. So could you just elaborate that for our listeners?
Right. So I would say I have a strong opinion that I believe that, you know, the conservative Bitcoin protocol development that has been going on for several years is the right path. But this is not a thing about right or wrong. It is about perspectives and trade-offs of what people are willing to make. Mm-hmm. And I understand it because I was a big blocker in the early days myself. It wasn't until I started having to run Bitcoin nodes and build Bitcoin infrastructure that I started to realize what some of these trade-offs really were. And so fundamentally, the scaling debate within Bitcoin that culminated in 2017 was a clash between wanting to prioritize the cost of on-chain transactions versus the perspective of wanting to prioritize the cost of auditing the history of the entire blockchain. And these two are essentially in conflict with each other, because in order to keep transactions cheap, in order to keep those the block space cheap, you have to have potentially infinitely large blocks. You have to just keep increasing the block size to whatever is required to prevent there being any pressure to get into the next block. And as you do that, it creates more and more data, and the blockchain never removes data. It just keeps adding data.
Yeah.
And you are geometrically increasing the amount of data that then has to be verified by someone who wants to come and join the network. And that was what I had an ultimate problem with, is that I was seeing the ability to run a node become more and more expensive.
Yeah. What do you think about that, John? I don't even know, John. Yeah. Are you passionate one way or the other?
You know, you just can't keep increasing the blocks. I think second layer solution was the most important, and to keep, like, put a fortress around Bitcoin and don't mess with it, because the security and everything is just censorship resistance. Nothing can compete with Bitcoin, right? So I think we just leave it as is until it's impossible to continue, and then we figure it out then. But I think you're right. I think Bitcoin
it's about incentives, right? The whole system is about incentives. And as I was seeing creating a system where there's no fee pressure and transactions are always practically free, that does not incentivize people to use the block space wisely or judiciously. Mm-hmm. I mean, just put whatever you want on there. Yeah. If you want to see, you know, look at EOS or look at Bitcoin SV or whatever, and how unmaintainably large these systems are becoming. Like, I can't even run an EOS node. And a BSV node is probably pretty hard too. So if we really want these systems to be maintainable and run not just for a few years, but for generations, like if we're really trying to replace money and build a global system, it mm-hmm. needs to be something that is accessible for as many people as possible in as many ways as possible.
Yeah, I was actually brought that up. Go ahead, John.
So even Ethereum blockchain, it takes how long to download the whole blockchain?
Yeah, well, you know, that's an issue of complexity. Of, you know, they have so many more features built into their protocol. It's much more computationally intensive, to the point that now, like, you can't even really sync the Ethereum blockchain if you have a spinning disk hard drive. You need to have at least a solid state hard drive. There's just so many operations that have to happen to get through there. And it's fascinating to see how the communities change in response to these things, is that usually they end up making trade-offs of, oh, just, you know, use the light client, you know, just skip forward to, you know, 1,000 blocks ago and assume that everything that happened before that is honestly being told to you by whatever nodes you connected to. So it's, once again, it's all about trade-offs.
That's not flying with the Bitcoin maximalist, is it? So James, man, like, you know, we have very like new people coming into this space. We get emails all the time say, okay, MMA fans, UFC fans, just regular average Joe, right? Okay, we just invested in Bitcoin. We just had Eddie Alvarez, the underground king, the ex-UFC champion, give Ben Askren a shout out on Twitter. He says, finally, I bought it. Okay, Ben, I bought it. Now
you
what?
John, you should. He didn't ask, but I would have said, just wait. There's probably going to be a pullback coming up here. You know, wait like 2 days or something, maybe.
Time to market.
Yeah.
It's all part of the process. You got to go through it. There's no shortcut.
So,
Jameson, for average regular people, what are some of the things that we can do as best practice to protect our information and have a little bit of privacy? Or, you know, because the things that you're doing is, I got to say, it's kind of extreme, right?
Yep.
So for regular people, what are some of the best practices that you would suggest to them?
So if you just spend a weekend looking at some of the technical things you can do, you know, setting up a VPN to help obscure your traffic, installing ad blockers in your browsers, I mean, simple things like that will get you like 95% of the way better than other people who are using the internet on a regular basis. So my original job, like the first 10 years of my career, was actually spent doing large-scale data analysis for online marketing companies. Hmm. And it was really the antithesis of what I do today, and perhaps contributes a bit to my perspective of understanding how much data is really being scooped up and analyzed. It's, you know, pretty much every web page that you're going to out there is chock full of various trackers that are sending your data back to some large farm that's then trying to like cross analyze it and correlate it with other tracking things you've done on other websites that share similar, tracker scripts on them. And most of it is innocuous enough. They're just trying to sell you more shit. But ultimately, this data is potentially sensitive, and you don't know what's going to happen if it leaks and it gets into the wrong hands. And that's what we continue to see happen over and over and over again, is that every time people are trusting their data with third parties, it's a ticking time bomb until some hacker gets in and that data gets abused.
Yes. That's no joke. Okay. I feel like that was a deep topic for our audience, John, but I'm gonna go one more semi-deep question. Jameson, I meant to tag you. I meant to tag you this morning because I do something called Mental Monday. I talk about thought processes for sports and stuff. And you were one of three people who all said roughly the same thing, which is it's Anti-Fragile by Nassim Tlaib, right? That whole thought process. Justin Gaethje, after his fight on Saturday night when he won, he said, "I needed to lose to change. I needed to get beat to get better. I realized I wasn't doing this, 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 and this." And, you know, I think that's such an important thought process for people to have. And a lot of people, they don't want to feel the pain, right? Because losing or failure, it drags along pain with it. But then you need the pain to force you to change, which is what Justin Gaethje said. And great people understand this. You were talking about, you know, how Bitcoin is open for attack essentially all the time, 24/7. Yep. But this is not a flaw. This is a feature. It only makes it stronger. So I don't know if there's a simple way to elaborate on that a little bit, but hopefully you can go a little bit into it.
Yeah, I mean, metaphors tend to work really well in this space just to get rid of a lot of the complexity. And I think the simplest metaphor that we can use is just your own immune system. You know, if we think of Bitcoin as an organism, and a number of people, including like prominent cryptographers, have called Bitcoin a new form of life. It is mm-hmm. this kind of decentralized organization that's comprised of all of us, regardless of whether you're a speculator or a coder or a shitposter. I mean, we're all contributing in our own way to this ethos, this thing that is Bitcoin. And that's part of the reason why no one can understand what it is because it is so diverse and distributed. But if we think in terms of how your own body fights off bad things, it's you have this army of, you know, like white blood cells that are going around looking for bad things. And when they see a bad thing, they react and they may create antibodies that help fight them off. And it's really the same type of thing within Bitcoin, but at a more macro level, where the white blood cells are the people like myself, or really anyone who is paying attention and looking for behavior that they consider to be antithetical to the ethos of the system. It may be technical things, it may be social things. You know, there are plenty of people who would say that some of the 2017 and scaling drama was a social attack on Bitcoin. There was this whole thing with SegWit2x being like a cabal of small organizations, basically enterprises within the Bitcoin ecosystem, trying to force through a change against consensus. It's all a fascinating thing to think about, like from a governance perspective. But I think that if you just think of it as an organism that is made up of many people, it starts to make a lot more sense. Like, that's why it's so chaotic, is, you know, there is no one authority that's controlling all of this. We're all doing our own thing, and whatever Bitcoin is just sort of organically evolves spontaneously as a result of all of these chaotic interactions.
That's a great way to explain it. Actually, that made me think something funny. Right? Ready for this, John? You inspired me. You inspired me. So I have a bunch of high school kids that come over and they work at my house in the summer on the disc golf course. And, you know, John's all about using the whatever crypto when he's out and about, you know, being an evangelist. And so I told all these kids, I said, listen, track your hours this summer. I will pay you in Bitcoin. And if on August 31st, it is below the price at which I paid you, I will make up the difference, right? So if you work 10 hours and you're supposed to be paid $100 and it's only worth 90 at that point in time, I'll make up the $10. I said, if you gain, you get to keep the gain. So I paid one kid, I think it was for 8 hours or something, he was over working. And the next day he's like, oh, I just made $3 more, you know, because Bitcoin went up. And then, you know, yesterday he texted me like, oh, what the hell? I just lost $7. I'm like, oh my goodness, he's getting fired up over $3 and $7. It was I was dying laughing. Oh man.
Yeah, we got to get people used to the volatility. You know, it takes a while to strap in to the Bitcoin roller coaster, and really I consider it to be like, you're an OG if you've survived an entire hype cycle. You know, once you've been through the mania phase where it looks like everything's going to the moon, nothing could go wrong, and then if you survive the 80-90% crash where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth, and you manage to get through that without panic selling and essentially rage quitting, then you're probably on the path to becoming a true hodler.
Yes, I agree.
Hey, totally. Lob, have you seen Ben Askren fight Robbie Lawler? Did you see that fight?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
Okay. So you need to watch that fight, and Ben Askren will teach you how to survive adversity and come out on top. You will see in that fight. I was watching the fight, and I literally was so worried because he was getting hit with some shots that would have knocked 99.99% of the people in this world out. And then he just rose from the ashes like Bitcoin and just came back and bulldog killed him, you know? Well, so, I mean, go ahead.
That's not what I was thinking, John. I'm not thinking about myself getting punched. I'm thinking I got in right as, you know, as we were doing the run up. And so I've seen mostly this, you know, and I've held the whole time. So listen, I am deserved a really, really, really nice bull run right now.
Well, after a 2-year bear market, I think we all do. But, you know, this is the way things go. hopefully history somewhat repeats itself.
Hey, oh, I forgot to ask you. Jameson, the other day, Ben Askren did a 1-minute Bitcoin halving explanation. And I think it's over like 80,000 views on Instagram and Twitter.
Nice.
Did you see it? And what is your thoughts on his 1-minute brief explanation of Bitcoin halving?
No, I wish I had. I'll have to check it out, though. Is it how technical?
Then check it out after the podcast.
Well,
and I want you to grade him 1 to 10 and how he did, because he likes compliments.
You know, the one thing that was really hard, John, I'll tell you, I usually try to do things in one take, but I want to do it in 1 minute because that's the Instagram time limit before it's got to go to the, you know, the longer frame. And getting it in a minute was really, really tough. I had to do it. I should send you an outtake because one time I almost nailed it and then I misspoke and then I started again, which misspeaking is fine. But then I realized, damn it, I'm going to miss it by like 3 seconds. And I started cussing up a storm. I was so annoyed.
You know what, though? So many people watched it because it was 1 minute. It was brief. And you had it on the whiteboard and you were talking like you were a coach. You know what I mean? So I like it. But Jameson, I got one other issue that really bothers me, right? Sure. Whenever I go to like a grocery store or to buy something, they always ask me for my phone number and my email. And, you know, I don't give out my email. I don't like to give out my phone number. And the funny thing is, they look at me like I'm so weird, right? Yep. And people behind me who are lining up, they're like, you know, what are you doing? Just give them your email. I'm like, no, I don't want to give my email. And it's not because of big security reasons. I just don't like to be
weirdo
spammed all the time, you know? So it's the same thing when you go to a restaurant, right? They say, oh, do you want cheese with that? Do you want fries with that? And then they don't even tell you that it's going to cost extra until you go to the lot and your bill has gone up. So it's these practices that the corporations are doing to steal your information so they can send you something behind the scenes. So what do you think about that? I don't like to feel like a dummy for not wanting to give out my phone number and email address.
For me, it depends on my mood. How much of an asshole do I want to be? You know, if I want to push back and be like, not going to happen, you know, then I might just be adversarial. But most of the time, if I don't want to create a scene and whatever, then I just give them fake info. I mean, they don't know. There's no way for them to validate. So you can make up an email or phone number that's easy to remember and just go with that.
All right. Hey, let's do, John, we're running out of time. Let's do our rapid fire questions, then I'm going to thank our sponsor, and then we're out of here. Does that sound good, Jameson?
Sounds good.
All right, rapid fire. Favorite follow on crypto Twitter?
Favorite follower of mine?
No, no, no. Who you follow? Who's the favorite? If you could only follow one person on crypto Twitter, who would it be?
Well, it's got to be Andreas Antonopoulos. He was basically the guy that inspired me the most to you know, be a public voice and try to help people understand Bitcoin.
Awesome. Okay. Then hopefully he might get two in a row. What is your favorite crypto book?
Ooh. I have to say Bitcoin Billionaires, because there were some interesting tidbits in there about like the Winklevoss and Charlie Shrem, et cetera. It's less of a technical book and more of a just like interesting personal history.
Yeah, that was a fun and easy read. Okay. Question number three, who is Satoshi?
I think Satoshi is a time traveling artificial intelligence from the future.
Is that a joke? Okay. Best price guess for December 31, 2020.
Oh God. Yeah. I preface everything by saying I have no idea about prices.
Yes.
But I guess it depends on if you believe in the stock to flow model that everyone else does. So I like to be conservative though. So instead of saying $250,000, I'll say, how about we shoot for $50,000 and be happy that it's an all time high.
I would be happy with that. Okay. James
says the guy who got into Bitcoin at $10.
Yeah. Right. That's only 500X. Or am I missing a zero? Okay, Jameson, we appreciate it. Let me give one quick shout out to our sponsor, BlockFi. You get $100 free today. Sign up for an account and put $200 in. You guys see that scrolling at the bottom of our screen? Just go to the link, try.blockfi.com/bitcoinhalving/promo/funky. Jameson, that was a blast. We appreciate you taking the time. I know you're very, very busy today. And guys, we have, I believe, 4 blocks left. Enjoy the rest of your days.
Happy halving.
Peace, guys.
All right. Stay funky, everyone.